The Bible and Modern Science with your host, Dr. Joseph Henson of the Science Faculty of Bob Jones University. Here is Dr. Henson.
Thank you. On our last program, we were on the verge of looking at an example of the difficulty that occurs for evolutionists who are trying to argue that all of the organisms that we see around us in nature today ultimately are all related and are related through a series of organisms that have existed previously on the earth that are referred to sometimes as common ancestors or intermediate species or perhaps a little bit more properly missing links, the latter name indicating simply and correctly that these things do not exist. And I'd indicated to you on the last program that we want to look at an example that I think might be helpful for people who do not have some background in science to understand the problem that exists for the evolutionist. Let's interrupt the imaginary evolution of organisms at some point in that series. Let's look at the begin with the amphibian, an amphibian, and consider what is supposed to happen to that amphibian from the standpoint of its ancestry. Where has it come from? And the evolutionary view of this, of course, is that is simply that amphibians developed from fish of some kind. And these fish, over long periods of time, I think in the minds of most evolutionists, through a series of tiny changes, developed eventually into the amphibian. Now, let's start with the fish and agree that there was an organism, or there were organisms, which were true fish. And later on in time, there are supposedly organisms that are true amphibians that have developed from these. So we would have an organism that is 100 parts fish. And further along in development, we would have an organism that is 100 parts, let's make it 1,000 just to keep things a little bit simpler, 1,000 parts amphibian. Now, what would be next to the fish? Well, there would have to be some kind of an organism that is slightly different from the fish and is in a series, part of a series that eventually is going to produce the amphibian. So we have an organism that is 999 parts fish and one part amphibian. On the other end of this, we would have an organism that is 999 parts amphibian and one part fish, almost an amphibian, but not quite. And then in the middle somewhere, we would have to have an organism that is half fish and half amphibian, 500 parts fish, 500 parts amphibian. And between these two, there would be a collection of organisms, thousands of them, that are some varying difference between fish and amphibia. Now, if you will take this section of the illustration and then fit that to the idea of the continuum that would have to exist between protozoans and people, all through that series, you would have organisms that are slightly different from one kind of organism on the way to becoming something else, and what you would find is simply an absolute chaos that's there. The point being, how do you know what really would be the real organism? Would it be the fish itself, or would it be the organism that is 999 parts fish and one part amphibian? Or would the real organism be the one in that is the combination of the two, the one that's half fish and half amphibian? And a couple of the obvious common sense problems that would occur as a result of this, in the first place, classification would be impossible. If that, in fact, is what we observed in nature, we simply would not know where to put the organisms we see or the organisms we find in the fossil record. And one of the things that are a consequence of this is that there ought to be unbelievably great numbers of organisms greater than the ones that we look at as the real organisms. instead of being a missing link, there would be jillions of missing links, jillions of organisms that are intermediate between one or the other of the organisms that we know, and we're really not real sure where they belong. Now, this simply is not the thing that we observe, either in nature or in the fossil record. I sometimes make the comment that any freshman zoology student worth his salt ought to be able to put 95% of the fossils that he finds into a proper phylum. And if the evolutionists were correct, then that simply would not be possible. And by the way, as a side thought here, this is a good example, one of the few places where it is possible to compare an evolutionary view and a creationist view with regard to the fossil record. If you are an evolutionist, what would you expect to find in the fossil record? And that series of organisms that I have just described is the sort of thing you would expect to find. What would you expect to find in the fossil record if you were a creationist? Well, obviously, you would expect to find clumps of organisms, horses or insects or worms or whatever, without any intermediate species. And when we go to the fossil record and begin to look there, we find the condition that we would expect on the basis of creation. We do not find the kind of thing that the evolutionist would expect to have. Now, tie that back, please, to our discussion in this case of the nematodes. We have not looked at the unusual characteristics of nematodes, but they are sufficiently different so that there is not any other organism that we find in nature today that could have existed as an ancestor from them, nor is there any organism that could be a descendant from them. They simply are there. We see them. They are alive. And they are unconnected to any other kind of an organism. And this gets us then to the consideration of the difficulty that we've been talking about. The creationists would argue that they are simply one of the variety of organisms God created. Now, we talked earlier a little bit about the problems of parasitism. When were they created? Did the parasites exist in the Garden of Eden and so on? And I'm not going to go back at this time and rehearse all the things that we said about that. So there are some problems for the creationists that are there. But those problems are very much less than the problems of trying the evolutionist attempting to connect nematodes with other organisms that are alive today, or providing an evolutionarily acceptable view of the so-called common ancestors and missing links that verge back into the fossil record. So that when we take the positions that we do, the knowledgeable position for a creationist is not some kind of far-fetched, irrational argument contrary to science. It is simply a willingness to look around in nature today and see the organisms that we find here, and in the case of the nematodes, study them if that's what you're inclined to do, as opposed to trying to come up with a purely mental construct, not science, but a mental construct that would link these organisms that we can see and study and work with in the lab to a series of ancestors that simply didn't exist. And so the creationist has much the better position with regard to trying to come up with the answers. Again, the evolutionists would say, well, you don't have any scientific evidence for creation and so on. And again, we have discussed this at great length. Doing that again is not my purpose. My purpose is to help those of you who accept the scripture as being authoritative and trustworthy to understand that there are sensible reasons for creationists to take a viewpoint very different, antagonistic to the idea of evolution. Now let's look at some of the unique characteristics. The nematodes, among other things, they are cylindrical, some of them small, some of them not as small. There are not any segments, any somites in these worms, as you notice in the earthworms, for example. One of the things that's unique to this group of worms is that they have a non-living cuticle. The outside of their body is covered with a covering which actually is made up of protein, collagen of a variety of sorts, and interestingly enough, the molecules of collagen there, in many cases, are virtually identical to the collagen that we find in human beings or in mammals. Now, the tempting explanation for that for the evolution is, oh, we're seeing collagen molecules in roundworms and collagen molecules in humans, and the chemical composition of these molecules is the same. Therefore, there must be a common ancestor somewhere between nematodes and people. Now, I really don't think there are any evolutionists that would try and argue that seriously. And as I have mentioned several times, we're going to stop and take some time sometime and discuss thoroughly this question of homology. Do similar structures, in this case similar chemical molecules, offer a basis for arguing that there had to be a common ancestor? Now, the real homology, there are instances where there are similarities that are a basis for arguing that organisms are related, but that requires the possibility of a reproductive relationship. Children resemble their parents, as everyone is aware, but there's a reason for that. They have a community of genetic material between them. Now, in the case of nematodes and humans, that's very different. And the fact that the molecules are the same does not in itself argue for a relationship, and particularly in those cases where the relationship is not possible. There is no way possible for nematodes to reproduce with humans or vice versa. So it simply is not a legitimate idea at that point. And we have noted on occasion a variety of examples of homology. It is true, for example, that the genetic material of humans is, whatever, 90-95% identical to that of monkeys. Does that mean, then, that there was a reproductive connection somewhere back down along the trail with a common ancestor for the two? And as we have discussed before, it really doesn't argue that at all. And if that is going to be a persuasive position taken by the evolutionists, then there has to be some indication of the possibility of the common ancestors, intermediate species, missing links, which, as we have just discussed, simply don't occur. For the evolutionists, it would be nice somewhere if there could be a series of these kinds of organisms that would appear, but they don't appear. They're not in the fossil record, and they're dead sure not in nature. And my opinion about these things is simply that the evolutionist is spending his time looking around for organisms that never existed, and that's the reason they're so difficult to come up with.
Thank you, Dr. Henson. You may send email to Dr. Henson at jhenson@bju.edu. That's jhenson@bju.edu. Or write to Dr. Joseph L. Henson, Box 34621, Bob Jones University, Greenville, South Carolina, zip code 29614, in the United States of America. You're invited to listen next time for The Bible and Modern Science.